everybody. Welcome to November's webinar. I'm filming this from Massachusetts, where Dr. Miles and myself have been involved in a 36-day meditation retreat. We are on, I believe, day 23 or 24 at this point, and I'm learning so much about the depths of meditation and the effects of going really, really deep. And I first want to just really highly encourage you guys to that, especially that are local, but if, you know, even those of you that are out of town, to start coming to our weekend mindfulness retreats, because what I feel is happening here from going deep with mindfulness and meditation is pretty exciting. The example I want to share has to do with many of you guys, I think most of you guys know that I have the mold genetics and I am extremely, extremely reactive to mold, and have a huge passion for treating mold, as I know you all know, because of my personal experience with it being so severe. And this place where we are taking this retreat has been quite moldy, and the first 19, 18 days or so were extremely uncomfortable for me. I had all of my mold symptoms and thought about leaving many, many times. But the research that we see in the best way to reset these mold genetics are still, or genetics in general, and this is still such a new area in epigenetics. We've studied a lot about what can turn genes on or off in the negative direction, but it's been really challenging in research thus far to show what can actually change genes back to being in their on or off position, whichever is positive for the body. And what we see to be likely able to have the largest effect here is meditation and mindfulness. And somewhere around day 18 or 19 of being in this moldy environment, all of a sudden my mold symptoms went away. So the headaches and the fatigue I was feeling and the pain in my body disappeared. And so it's, you know, it's hard to say for sure, but right now I'm super, super suspicious of the likelihood that my mold genetics have been turned off. And like any good scientist, I will still be collecting data in known moldy places to make sure that, you know, that my data is accurate. But I just wanted to share that with you guys, because I think not only for yourselves in proper epigenetic expression for your own wellness, but also in understanding how to truly guide your clients through the depths of an amazing mindfulness practice is just so, so, so important. And really, in, you know, reaching ultimate health, we can get people on great protocols that are going to help with their mitochondrial dysregulation and their genetic predisposal to certain diseases. But we're only going to get so far if we're telling people how to cope with whatever genetic expression using diet and lifestyle and all these great tools. But if we don't actually start looking deeper at how can we actually get these genes that have been expressed negatively to unexpress, we are only taking people to a certain point. So please, 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 if you have not been coming to these weekend workshops, please start coming so that we can help train you not only in your own world and your own practice and your own health, but start training you on how to guide your people through mindfulness practices and through meditation. So just wanted to share that with you. And then just a little housekeeping before we get into some of the depths of this. There are multiple people that are submitting things to our lab upload site that have people's names on them. And some people are working on submitting things within, they're making an attempt. Some of you are making an attempt to get the name off, which is great. It's a good first step. But what we're finding is just putting a black, like a black Sharpie line through somebody's name does not actually eliminate the ability to see that who that person is. So for legal HIPAA purposes, we can't really show these labs if they have somebody's names and they can be read in any way. So we have a couple cases that I can't show a piece of the labs you submitted because I can still see the person's name on it. So just please, please, please make sure that when you're submitting those, make sure that you are not just Sharpieing their name out, but instead making sure that you are whiting it out or cutting it out or just, you know, getting rid of it in some fashion so that I can actually go over these labs for you. So that would be really, really helpful. The other thing that'll be really helpful is if you can just pay attention to how you're scanning these things in. Oftentimes these are showing up upside down or to the right or to the left. And in order for us to show these well so that everybody can see, we really do need you guys to submit them in a way where it looks like we're reading through them just like we would if they're in their upright fashion. So if you guys can just do that to help us out, we can make sure that we get through all of your questions and your submissions. So thank you for that. And in another area before we start going into some of these submissions, another thing that I wanted to bring up for you guys that has come up in questions is when it's just kind of a deeper understanding of mold illness and when to treat. So from a diagnostic standpoint, mold illness is pretty hard to diagnose as far as just being 100% sure with our diagnosis, because there's not like a perfect lab test. You know, we have a lab test for SIBO where they have positive breath, and it's very, very clear with that SIBO breath test that using the parameters that we do, we can get a pretty good sense if somebody has SIBO or not. There's obviously people that can be the low end of SIBO that sometimes we have a little bit of a borderline feeling about if it's truly positive or negative. But in general, SIBO testing is fairly accurate with actually looking and saying, yes, we can diagnose somebody with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and need to do that treatment, or that we do not. Now, the challenge with mold is that there's not a prominent test that actually shows that somebody 100% sure has mold illness. And other disease processes like Lyme can be this way too, where it's like, yes, somebody can show very clearly positive for Lyme, but there's a lot of borderline with Lyme and a lot of different variation on how we determine that we are going to interpret those Lyme results. So with mold, the first thing that we really always need to consider with mold is, are they genetically sensitive? So remember that we're gonna test people for mold that have a few different qualifications. So oftentimes there's pain or some sort of neurological problem. So one of those two or both of those two are almost always present. I don't know if we've seen anybody without either pain or neurological dysfunction in some way. So pain is tends to be a little bit less migratory than Lyme. So pain can be all over the body. It can be like fibromyalgia type of pain. It's really, really common to have headaches or migraines with mold as well. So not always there, but classic symptoms are headaches and migraines, fibromyalgia, joint pain. It can actually look a lot like joint pain of arthritis. So if somebody has joint pain and they have a negative rheumatoid factor and a negative anti-CCP3 on their blood work, that can be a big sign that, oh, this pain may be caused by mold illness. So those are classic neurological symptoms, meaning brain fog or numbness and tingling, lack of clarity, all of these type of symptoms. Sometimes it can be in more severe cases, much more motor dysfunction from a neurological standpoint. So we could see some twitching disorders, some trembling, some gait disturbances. Those can all be mold, as well as things that are harder to treat and identify causes, like tinnitus or eye problems, night vision issues. All of these are common mold things. Mold also, in many cases, can have nausea. So think about nausea. If somebody has nausea for unknown origin, in combination with a lot of these other symptoms, that can be classic mold. And there's almost always fatigue. Mold people do not tend to have much energy at all. So if you're seeing some of these symptoms and people have seen a bunch of doctors and they've tried some of the basic things, you know, we've ruled out things like B12 deficiency for fatigue or iron deficiency, those types of things, we want to be considering mold. We really need to be aware that adrenal issues and thyroid issues, other causes of fatigue, can actually be caused by mold illness. So mold illness can cause HPA axis dysregulation, can cause HPT access this regulation. So we want to make sure that we are considering that if we see an adrenal or thyroid issue plus all of these other symptoms or some of these other symptoms, that it could be mold as that underlying root cause. So if we're suspecting it, step number two then is to run the first basic test, which is the HLA-DR test. And the HLA-DR test is where we're seeing, is this person in the 24th percentile where they are going to have a problem with mold? Now, if somebody is not in that 24th percentile, if they're in the 76th percentile, it's certainly possible they could still be having a IgE reaction to mold, and that maybe mold is a piece of the puzzle, but as far as being like the large piece of what's causing systemic symptoms, then we can say, okay, mold is less, highly much less likely to be an issue. So once we've done that HLA-DR test, now we're like more strongly ruling in mold as a possibility. The next test to consider is TGF-beta-1. That's a transcription or transforming growth factor beta-1. It's known as both by various lab companies. And with that TGF-beta-1, that's what we're seeing in the mold world and the mold research to be like the number one marker that's most highly correlated with mold illness. Now, there's other common things we'll see with mold illness, and the other common things we can see as far as lab testing include MMP9 elevations or MSH decrease. So we'll see MMP9, matrix metalloproteinase 9, or melanocyte stimulating hormone. We'll see MMP9 go up or MSH go down. So the most common one we see is TGF-beta-1 elevate. And that, if we see that in combination with an HLA-DR, that's pretty most likely going to be a mold illness. Now, there's other things that can cause a TGF-beta-1 elevation, but not other things that are going to commonly cause a TGF-beta-1 elevation and all of these symptoms that I just mentioned. So if somebody has these symptoms plus an HLA-DR plus an elevated TGF-beta-1, we should go ahead and treat them for mold illness. Now, if somebody has a lower level of TGF-beta-1, like a normal level, and they still have the HLA-DRs, that's when we can consider looking at MMP9 and MSH to say, okay, well, are these expressing? And if those are, if we still see a low MSH and an elevated MMP9, then we also want to treat for mold in that condition. So times where we would say, oh, we want to not look at, if we see an elevated TGF-beta-1 and we have no mold genetics, those would be times where if somebody is in that 76% of non-HLA-DRs for mold and they have an elevated TGF-beta-1, then we're going to look for other causes of elevated TGF-beta-1, so other causes of tissue breakdown. But for situations where we see that classic mold picture plus the HLA-DR plus that TGF-beta-1, we want to treat them for mold illness. Now, one of the things that's come up in clinic where people have questions that are starting to understand some of this mold is that if we have to test the house for mold, right? So if we have somebody come in with all of these symptoms and they are positive HLA and they're positive TGF, the next thing we need to do before treatment is to test their house. Now, testing the house and seeing if the house is positive or negative for mold is not doing anything for telling us if we're going to treat that person for mold. So we are going to treat that person for mold if they have positive HLA-DR, if they have a TGF-beta-1 that's positive, and if they have symptoms for mold. We're going to treat them for mold regardless of their house. Because with the mold genetics, what the mold genetics are telling us is that person has a genetic anomaly, a genetic expression, an epigenetic expression where they are not able to break down mold toxins. So this means that this person could have mold, they could have mold exposure 10 years ago in a severe way that, say, built up in their body. And even though they're not having that acute exposure now, those toxins are still circulating in their blood because of that gene and that exposure 10 years ago. So the only thing that testing the house is really telling us is their house safe? Are we going to be effective with starting the treatment now? Because if we're trying to get mold toxins out of somebody's body and they're still living in a moldy house, you can see how that's going to be very difficult to make any forward progress because we're trying to detox them when they're still in a toxic environment. So if we get these basic tests run and we say, yes, we want to treat them for mold, And then we test their house. If their house is positive, what that means is we actually do not begin treatment until they have remediated their house or gotten themselves out of that toxic environment. So it means we hold off on treatment is what that is telling us by testing their house. Now, if we wind up testing their house and their house turns out to be negative, all that's telling us is, hooray, we don't have to go through mold remediation and we can start down mold treatment now. It does not mean that we start looking for other reasons for TGF-beta-1 because we have mold genetics, we have all the symptoms of mold. And though once we have those symptoms in line with that TGF-beta-1 and those genetics, that's basically telling us that, yes, the likelihood of this being mold is more likely than any other condition out there. So that's the first thing we should look at. You know, just like with SIBO, how sometimes we have SIBO and SIFO. And so sometimes we finish SIBO and we say, oh, well, we want to, there's still some residual bloating here. So maybe we need to consider SIFO, and there's not a good test for SIFO. We can do certain things that lead us down that path, such as an organic acids, looking for that arabinose or elevation, or looking and saying, oh, well, maybe if there's yeast in the stool, there could be yeast in the small intestine, but there's really not a good SIFO test. So we start with what we know most to be most likely based upon the best clinical information we have in that situation to be treating SIBO. And then if there's still something else left that feels GI-wise and there still seems to be residual after the SIBO treatment, and we then can treat for SIFO, or we would maybe do them concomitantly at the same time if we found, say, elevated yeast on the organic acids. So same thing with mold and an elevated TGF-beta-1. If we see this elevated TGF-beta-1, then we really need to consider the fact that, yes, there could be, is likely mold. And while we can get online and see and research, there's, yes, other reasons for TGF-beta-1, we don't tend to go and run down those other reasons, because clinically what we find is that when people have this conglomeration of HLA-DR, TGF-beta-1, both showing up positive on labs, and mold symptoms, it tends to be mold. And we treat the mold and we detox the mold and people get better. So we know that we're on the right track. So it's kind of like that saying that many of us get taught in medical school, which is, if you hear hooves, think horses, not zebras. And what we're basically saying is, like, start with the most obvious. If we're having something being shown to us that seems very, very likely that it's mold, or very, very likely that it's Lyme or SIBO or whatever it is, that's the road we go down first before we start running additional tests and going down a whole nother different road. So, and then just to be clear too, Marcon. So Marcon's is a multiple antibiotic resistant coagulase negative staph. And Marcon's is that type of staph that lives very far back in our sinus cavity, right where our sinus cavity is kind of coming down and meeting our eustachian tube. So right in the back of the throat here. And so with that meeting, with that, the fact that staph lives that far back, oftentimes classic ENTs are not testing for it. And it's very difficult to get rid of mold. It makes it a lot harder to get rid of mold if somebody has Marcon. So if we are determining if we are going to treat somebody for mold, we should also do a nasal swab for Marcon's. Now, Marcon's will show it's testing for bacteria and for this coagulative negative staph. And they also, the swab, the company, they also test for fungus. So another thing that's come up that I want to make sure everybody is clear about is just because a Marcon swab is negative for fungus does not mean that there is no reason to treat for mold. These are two totally separate issues, because when we're dealing with mold illness, we're not talking about, like, mycotoxin illness, CIRS, is not saying that we have a problem with mold actually growing inside of our body. So we could culture and we could see that there's no mold inside of our body and we can still have CIRS, we can still have mycotoxin illness. Mycotoxin illness is not saying mold growing inside the body. What it is saying is that our liver and our detoxification system, due to epigenetic factors, are having a difficult time detoxing the toxins from mold that we were exposed to at some point in our life. So having a negative culture of that fungus is common, is very, very common. The funguses that they're actually testing for in the nose are not all the same funguses that we're worried about anyways from mycotoxin illness. But we're dealing with two completely separate issues. Somebody could have fungus growing in their body and could have and could not have CIRS. They might have a totally different set of symptoms, and it's not the same thing as actually dealing with that toxic breakdown. So I want to make sure that's clear, that we're not talking about mold growing inside of our body when we're doing these tests. We're talking about toxic toxins backing up because our body is not capable, due to our HLA expression, of actually breaking down those toxins. So just want to make sure that's clear, because that is coming up in some conversations I'm having with people at the clinic, that there's some unclear understanding of this. So that's what I want to say about that. And then let's jump in and look at some of these questions that have come up. So first one I'm going to look at, I'm going to pull up here, is this one is submitted by Brooke, and we have a female, age 56, total exhaustion, breathing issues, chronic fatigue, bloating and gas, poor digestive function, insomnia, and poor memory. So already we're thinking of a few different things. We're definitely thinking there could be mold, we're thinking there could be adrenals, there could be thyroid issues, SIBO, enzyme deficiency, insomnia, and poor memory. So that could be anything from nutrient deficiency to blood sugar issues to cardiovascular problems to digestive problems to mold or toxic issues. So let's now look at some of the things that you have found here, Brooke. So some of these symptoms starting after living in an apartment, they had found out that they had a lot of mold. So here's already a big red flag. She always had some GI discomfort, but nothing bothered her a whole lot. So this is where this kind of illustrates what I was saying, that we oftentimes see that mold can cause nausea. So some GI dysfunction, but after living in this apartment, she started suffering from brain fog, fatigue, and breathing issues. And I am imagining, since you're saying that GI dysfunction did not bother her a whole lot, that possibly it got worse after living in this moldy place, but you didn't comment on that. So after another year of living in the moldy place, they figured out the problem. They've been out of the apartment, in a living situation, tested to be free of mold for 10 months now. Changed her diet completely, started eating paleo, very clean, and her symptoms are 30% better with the diet change. Now she wants to know what she can do, as her brain fog is severe and the fatigue keeps her from doing the things she wants to do. She's able to work one day per week, but that's it. So it's good, you know, when we see that changed diet completely, started eating paleo, very clean. So, you know, eating paleo may or may not be the best diet for this person, but certainly cleaning things up, getting sugar out, making sure fats are out, proper and like healthy, and eating very clean, eating organic, these sorts of things are obviously very important in this sort of condition, because what we're really doing here is we're starting to rule things out. You know, did she have something go on in her life where between stress and her environment that her dietary choices, if they were poor, started affecting her more than they previously did? So there's always certainly that possibility. So this is good, you know, a good place for people to obviously come in, because they've already taken care of some of the basics, changed the diet, and now we know that it's not that. So she's able to work one day per week, but that's it. So your question here is that you've not worked with mold toxicity issues as we do in the practice. You think this would be a great case study for me, but you want to make sure that you give her with the appropriate tests and approaches. You've uploaded the only lab she gave you, suggested SIBO breath test, good, you know, that bloating gas, absolutely. Certainly consider stool culture as well. So you said the doctor's got a CDSA, you're already thinking about that. And you thought that would be a good idea to go ahead and get the organic acids. I definitely agree with all of that. You know, looking at some of the detoxification and liver markers are a great idea, but just to always put things into context that we are not necessarily going to get the information that we need out of the organic acids around detoxification. We're really not going to get what we need as far as diagnosing mold illness. So certainly if we see with the organic acids, if we see signs of like glutathione deficiency, for example, like that can be a big thing that can make mold illness worse, but it's still not going to be able to diagnose it. So I think it's a great idea to run, and I think it will absolutely help your case. But just to emphasize, and I think you probably know this, that it's really not going to diagnose anything. So what we need to do, the basic things to run here, the first thing really is, like I was just giving an intro on this, is the HLA-DRs. Dr. Miles is in the room with me here, so I'm going to ask if he has the code for LabCorp memorized. Do you, Dr. Miles?
I think it's 167120.
So he thinks it's 167120 is the LabCorp test code for the HLA-DRs. And then the other one we want to make sure we run is transcription factor or transforming factor. It can be listed on as either TGF-beta-1. And so I would say start with those. If you want to do a more thorough test, you could add in an MMP9 and an MSH. So those are the basic things. And then I go off of Shoemaker's guidelines. So Dr. Richie Shoemaker's the one in the field who's done most of the mold research. So he says the mold or the TGF-beta-1 should be under about 2,300, which is gonna be very, very different than the lab value. So, you know, get on Richie Shoemaker's site and look at the lab values for what he's suggesting and use those as your baseline lab values, because they will be quite a bit different than what you're seeing in the with the LabCorp. So start right away with the HLA-DRs and the TGF-beta-1, and then it sounds like the apartment is pretty clear that they have mold. So the other thing that I would really be considering right away is, are they still in that apartment? And if they're still in that apartment, they've been out of that apartment. So you said all of that's clear. And so if they were still in the apartment and if there was mold there, then we would want, or if they had it remediated, we would also want to make sure that we had them retest using a HERTSMI or an ERMI test that will actually tell us if there are mycotoxins within that apartment still, for the reasons that I've already discussed and disclosed. So other things to really consider, certainly when we're dealing with, you know, breathing issues and total exhaustion, we should consider things like B12 deficiency or maybe even antiparietal cell antibodies attacking that the parietal cells, causing a B12 deficiency and causing an HCL deficiency possibly as contributing to that poor digestive function. So we consider those things. Definitely consider an HPA axis and HPT axis dysregulation of some degree. Definitely running some basic CBC, CMP, you know, some basic classic labs to make sure that somebody is in a good situation regarding some of just the basics, you know, seeing what their white blood cell functions like, making sure liver and kidneys are okay. So just making sure that we're covering our bases there. And then those are kind of the main places I would start. I would consider probably doing a Marcon's for her. So making sure that nasal passageway is clear. And the reason for that really is in part beyond wanting to get somebody well, it's also that with mold, like I mentioned, it's very, very, very difficult to get somebody well, to get somebody in a good, healthy place as far as mold illness if they have Marcon. So big first step is actually with getting somebody well is getting them out of that healthy place and making sure we're starting them on a Marcon's protocol. And with that, we're just not going to get very far with mold illness, we find, if somebody also has Marcon's. It's really difficult. So other things to consider, I think you're on the right track here. I mean, we can certainly consider some mitochondrial dysfunction. It's knowing there's mold, every single symptom that you are listing here could be involved purely with mold as being the number one root cause. So I certainly wouldn't jump down, honestly, too many other places than that, especially since you've already done some great basics like SIBO and the CDSA and the organic acids. I think those are the main other basics. So if you're not getting well, that's when, you know, if there's still something residual after doing this, that's when you could consider more things like going and doing like a full Dutch and looking at that, maybe even considering a GI map, because that's going to test for different microorganisms than the doctor status CDSA. We can consider things like, is it possible there is any sort of asthma or any sort of chronic obstructive pulmonary issue that's causing the breathing issues? Or do we just need pure mitochondrial support? Is there any sort of Epstein-Barr or chronic viral picture that's causing this? So those would kind of be some of the next areas to look at. But again, back to this, you know, the classic medical thing of like, if you hear hooves, think horses. Starting with what's most obvious is definitely the place to go. And I would give, knowing that this person has been in a moldy place, I think you're going to see the positive HLA-DRs. I think you'll probably see an elevated TGF-beta-1. So as long as you're getting the lab work to verify this and we see that there was mold there and this seems extremely, extremely clear, I would probably do a mold treatment for a SIBO, and you know, if anything else comes up with the organics, I would probably do 6 solid months with this case, working with what comes up positive, provided there is mold here in or mold lab work that verifies the mold. I'd probably do it 6 months before I would jump into considering some of these other things that I mentioned, because this is just one of those cases that just seems so obvious. So that's kind of it there. That's what I would focus on for this one.